This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Across the conflict duration, since October, over a third of buildings in Gaza and Rafah have been damaged, and all the new damage, most of the new damage in the last update that we did was focused in the evacuation zone in eastern Rafah.
That was Corey Scherer of the Graduate Center at the City University of New York, who says satellite imagery of Rafah taken shortly after Israeli forces moved into the area shows widespread damage. Details coming up. Also, a man attacked a mosque in Nigeria during morning prayers yesterday, injuring at least 24 worshippers. And government in Tunisia continues to crack down on lawyers. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. A Tunisian court has ordered two journalists to remain in jail after they were arrested for making comments critical of the government. They were arrested Saturday, and lawyers also have been arrested over the past few days. Eliza Volkman reports from Tunis.
A judge on Wednesday ordered the continued detention of two prominent journalists pending further investigations. Their lawyers say Murad Zaidi and Burhan Besaïs were detained Saturday over political comments they made on the radio. Police also arrested Sonia Dahmani, a high-profile human rights lawyer and media pundit, that same night. Then on Monday, police raided the offices of the Tunisian Bar Association as part of the response to a national lawyers' strike to protest what they say is a worsening situation for lawyers, journalists and civil society members. During Monday's raid, police seized Mehdi Zagrouba, who is a leading figure in the Association of Young Tunisian Lawyers. Many lawyers have said that they are now afraid to speak publicly for fear of violent reprisals or arrest. Tunisian lawyer Ibrahim Barith, who lives in exile in France, has been in contact with fellow attorneys who described Monday night's raid to him. He says the lawyers told him several armed police officers descended on the offices of the Bar Association. They threatened lawyers by pointing their weapons at them, telling them to stop filming on their phones. Barith says they apparently pushed lawyer Mehdi Zagrouba to the floor before taking him by force. Police officers then returned to smash the glass doors, fittings and furniture. The Minister of Interior says Zagrouba was arrested for verbally abusing and physically assaulting a police officer. Dahmani's arrest came after she failed to appear in court on Friday on a summons under the country's two-year-old cybercrime law, which bars what is vaguely described as fake news. Human rights organizations allege it criminalizes criticism of state authorities. Journalists in Tunisia say at least 39 colleagues have been charged under this law, or the Anti-Terrorism Act. At a news conference in Tunis, the head of the Bar Association, Hatem Mezoui, called the arrest heavy-handed and said everyone has the right to defense without power abuse or resorting to violence. Interior Ministry spokesperson Fikret Bouzgaya has said the ministry treats all sectors equally and has no issue with either the judiciary or lawyers. He called on lawyers to pay attention to certain parties who want to incite confusion between the legal sector and national authorities. Bouzgaya also said the ministry is independent of all political battles. Stuart Russell is the co-chair of the Monitoring Committee on Attacks on Lawyers at the International Association of People's Lawyers. He has been following reported attacks on Tunisian lawyers closely for some years. He says such crackdowns are often used by authoritarian governments.
The significance of the most recent events, I would say, is a classic authoritarian strategy, a desperate attempt for the regime to cling to power. It knows that its days are numbered. It knows that lawyers, journalists, human rights activists, unionists, members of civil society are demonstrating and protesting. They want justice and they want change and they want it now. It's very frightening for authoritarians. Do you see a nation rising up against it?
Tunisia's President Kais Saied, elected in 2019, seized control over parliament and most elements of government in 2021. Critics and human rights groups say he has increasingly cracked down on the opposition and limited civil rights. Bar associations around the world have issued statements of solidarity with Tunisian lawyers. France and the European Union have also voiced concerns over the crackdown. A United States Department spokesperson Tuesday said the actions are inconsistent with what we think are universal rights guaranteed in Tunisia's constitution. For Voice of America Africa, I'm Elysia Falkman in Tunis, Tunisia.
In the latest developments, hundreds of lawyers, activists and others today demonstrated in the Tunisian capital over the arrest of the two lawyers. Lawyers also alleged that one of the arrested attorneys, Mahdi Zagrouba, had been tortured in detention. He collapsed in court today and was taken to a hospital. The government has denied allegations of torture. Also today, President Kais Saied denounced foreign interference following international criticism of the arrests of political commentators, lawyers, and journalists. Chad's Constitutional Council is expected today to declare final results of the May 6th presidential election and name transitional President General Mahamat Idriss Deby as the winner. This despite calls for annulment of the polls due to what the opposition says was massive fraud. Analysts say uncertainty lies ahead as tensions remain high. Moki Edwin Kindeka reports from neighboring Cameroon.
Residents of N'Djamena say that since Wednesday night, there has been a massive deployment of troops on streets and what they call the capital city's strategic locations and neighborhoods considered to be opposition strongholds. 24-year-old Abdul Kuleman is a student at the University of N'Djamena. He spoke with VOA on Thursday morning via a messaging app.
Les activités sont freinées dans les arrondissements de la ville de N'Djamena due au problème des inquiétudes.
Kuleman says business has been at a standstill in N'Djamena since Chad's Constitutional Council announced on Wednesday night that results of the Central African State's May 6 presidential elections are to be proclaimed on Thursday. Kuleman says the presence of heavily armed troops deployed by Chad's military government all over N'Djamena scares civilians. He says streets are empty because civilians have decided to remain in their houses as tension is perceived in the city. Last week, Chad's Elections Management Body, or ANJ, announced that Mahamat Deby had won the May 6th election with 61% of votes. Monday, several opposition candidates filed petitions with the Constitutional Council challenging the official results. They say there was massive electoral fraud, including the stuffing of ballot boxes and soldiers chasing opposition representatives from polling stations. Prime Minister Success Masra, who finished second with 18%, says voters were intimidated and arrested. Deby calls the allegations unfounded. Deby, earlier this week, said he is now the president of all Chadians, including candidates who did not win the May 6 polls. He says he is now concentrating in respecting his electoral promises, especially bringing back peace to Chad. Opposition and civil society groups say they are also surprised over the council's announcement that it was ready to finalize the election results without ruling on the petitions. Electoral laws give the council until May 21 to rule on petitions, according to the opposition. The council has already said that election day incidents like fighting and the late arrival of ballot boxes to polling stations were not enough to influence the outcome of the vote. Beran Baikubu is spokesperson for an opposition party, the Movement of Chad Patriots for the Republic, or MPTR.
Comment est-ce que de manière aussi expéditive le travail a été fait?
He says it is now evident that Chad may descend into violence and chaos after Thursday's proclamation of definitive results by the Constitutional Council because Deby rigged elections by falsifying results sheets and intimidating civilians with his military. He says the results declared by ANJ and to be confirmed by Chad's Constitutional Council were prepared by Deby, who wants to confiscate power. Baikubu said civilians should stay at home to avoid confrontations with the military, which he says was deployed by Deby to crack down on people protesting election results. Deby took power in April 2021 as leader of a transitional government after his father, Idriss Deby Itno, who had ruled Chad for more than three decades, died fighting northern rebels. Lidi Besemda is the only female who contested the polls. Speaking on Chad State TV Thursday, she said that by confiscating power, Debi is failing to show love for the country. She says Chad is becoming a Debi dynasty. The Economic Community of Central African States, or SEAC, says Chadians should avoid chaos by protesting peacefully if they feel cheated in the elections. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You're listening to African News Tonight on the Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. A man attacked a mosque in northern Nigeria's Kano State during morning prayers yesterday, injuring at least 24 worshippers, including 4 children. Police told the Associated Press and other news outlets that a preliminary forensic analysis suggested a gasoline explosion, but a full investigation was still going on. A police statement said the suspect, a 38-year-old resident of the area, confessed he carried out the attack purely in hostility following a prolonged family disagreement over an inheritance. The incident caused panic in Kano, where periodic religion-related unrest has occurred over the years. South Africa told the United Nations top court today the situation in Gaza has reached a new and horrific stage as it sought emergency measures to halt Israel's military operation in the enclave's southern city of Rafah. It was the third time the International Court of Justice held hearings on the conflict since South Africa filed proceedings at the Hague Court in December accusing Israel of genocide. In January, judges ordered Israel to do all it can to prevent death, destruction, and any acts of genocide in Gaza, but stopped short of ordering an end to the military offensive. In March, the court said Israel must take measures to improve the humanitarian situation. Israel has strongly denied committing genocide in Gaza, saying it does all it can to spare civilians and is only targeting Hamas militants. The country says Rafah is the last stronghold of the militant group. Israel has denounced South Africa's allegations and will present its reply to the latest case tomorrow. Israel invaded Gaza in October after Hamas militants in the territory attacked Israel communities, killing about 1,200 people and taking more than 200 hostage. Gaza health officials say about 39,000 people have died in the enclave since then. Satellite imagery taken this month after Israel forces pushed into the Rafah area shows widespread damage to the southern Gaza city, along with hundreds of buildings that were likely damaged or destroyed between May 4th and May 8th. Satellite imaging expert Corey Scheer of the Graduate Center at the City University of New York tells VOA's Carol Van Dam, the maps show large areas of flattened structures, but it is impossible to say exactly what caused the damage.
So we saw new damage in the eastern part of Rafah, coincident with the area that Israel issued as an evacuation zone, it looks like. There was a little under 900 buildings that registered as new damage in that 4-day period, and that brought the total number of damaged buildings is over 17,000, which is 36% of buildings in Rafah.
So that's over a third of the buildings.
And that's across the conflict duration. So across the conflict duration since October, over a third of buildings in Gaza in Rafah have been damaged. And all the new damage, most of the new damage in the last update that we did was focused in the evacuation zone in eastern Rafah, where Israel has apparently moved in.
When you zero in on that evacuation area, can you even see, like, I know you can see buildings, but can you even see whether or not there's as many people or fewer people?
Not with our methods. We've worked with other methods, which are looking at the movements of tents, for example. There's been a lot of reported movements of tents clearing out in that area from internally displaced people. But for the building damage assessment, we can't see that directly. What we're looking at is damaged or destroyed buildings.
And what about the rest of Gaza during this most recent period? What does your imagery show?
There was some new damage that registered in the Khan Yunis area and a little bit in Deir Abala. So these are the central districts. And the northern areas were stable, so we're not registering any new damage because most of the area that we've been monitoring has already registered as damage in the north.
You guys have been doing this for a while, following and tracking this through your satellite imagery. And how does the damage, and I guess it would be connected to the strikes, compare with earlier months, you know, like, say, 3-4 months ago?
So I guess an important caveat is that we can't say exactly what caused the damage from this vantage point. It's most probably airstrikes, but it could also be munitions from the ground. There's been reported controlled demolitions happening. All sorts of stuff like that could be causing the actual damage. We've been monitoring damage to built-up areas across Gaza since the start of this campaign in early October on a roughly weekly basis. And what we saw over the first 3 months was rapid expansion of damaged areas in particularly the northern Gaza governorate, Gaza City governorate. And following the temporary ceasefire in November, the focus of new damage started to shift south progressively in the Deir Abala, Khan Yunis governorates, and now in Rafah. So the focus of damage, just as the reported conflict hotspots, have shifted south, and we've been tracking indicators of that damage with satellite radar on a weekly basis, 7 months.
Can you even tell with what you're looking at if it's like major hospital facilities, things like that, that are damaged?
Yeah, thanks. So we recently co-authored a paper that we published with medical doctors and epidemiologists from the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative, documenting damage to hospital and healthcare facilities across Gaza. But to make a long story short, these damage grids that we can detect automatically with the physical change can be overlaid with geospatial data on hospitals, for example, or any other infrastructure of interest to see whether or not damage has registered in those areas.
That is Corey Scherer, a doctoral candidate with the Department of Earth and Environment Science at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam. According to the Chinese Loans to Africa database, Chinese financiers signed 1,188 loan commitments worth $160 billion with African governments and their state-owned enterprises between 2000 and 2020, predominantly in transportation, power generation, mining, and telecommunications. The top loan recipient countries over the past 20 years included Angola, Zambia, Ethiopia, Kenya, Nigeria, and Cameroon, and most recently, the largest recipients, including Ghana, South Africa, and Cote d'Ivoire. China is now Africa's biggest trading partner, with two-way trade topping $200 billion a year. Wolfgang Porstai, senior advisor at the Austrian Institute for Security, explained to VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi how the affects the Chinese influence in Africa.
Nowadays, China is certainly the single most influential foreign actor in Africa, although this is still ignored by many people in the United States and also in Europe. Cheap products from China, the reasonable quality, are flooding African markets. Chinese companies dominate the construction sector, especially in many of the poorer African regions. Roads, railways, hospitals, power plants, and harbors are built by Chinese companies, usually with their own well-trained Chinese workforce. All these costs money, lots of money. And consequently, several African countries are now more or less dependent on loans from China, even for paying back their own debts. I would say they are now in a debt spiral from which it will be difficult to escape, although China recently also started to forgive some of its debts. Altogether, this makes a growing number of African countries very much dependent on China, and this gives China an easy access to Africa's vast natural resources.
Between 2011 and 2015, China financed more than 200 young African political leaders. In 2015, the program expanded when China said it would host 1,000 young African political leaders by 2018. The Office of Chinese Language Council International manages overseas Chinese language learning Confucius Institutes, including 61 in Africa. The institute's scholarships have contributed to the number of African students studying in China, growing 26-fold in 12 years, and now there are more African students in Africa than in the United States. From a strategic point of view, what is China trying to achieve from this soft power influence in Africa?
This is a very clever approach by the Chinese. China seeks to build a lasting relationship with African countries, and this including through with the country's elites. As the United States perfectly knows, many things are much easier if we have a personal connection, a personal relationship with those in charge. And part of this China soft power is also that they are deploying hundreds and thousands of Chinese health personnel to Africa, winning somehow hearts and minds. Nevertheless, I would like to stress, learning the Chinese language is a real challenge also for the African students. And while many of the candidates for studies abroad in European countries or in the United States have at least basic skills in English or French, with regards to Chinese, most of them start from scratch.
According to U.S. Foreign Affairs Committee, China revealed plans to allocate $6.6 billion to fund the expansion of Chinese state media in Africa. But the external propaganda budget is now approximately $10 billion. In 2018, Ugandan authorities enlisted Chinese company Huawei technicians to assist them in penetrating the digital communications of Bobi Wine, an opposition member of the parliament who was running against President Museveni in 2021, which led to the arrest of Mr. Wine and dozens of his supporters. What do you make of China's surveillance and media influence in sub-Saharan Africa?
Well, two answers. First, media. China seeks to shape also the mindset of the population in a pro-China way. This should help to establish a positive environment for Chinese investments and also for the many Chinese working nowadays in the respective African countries. Surveillance. China usually supports the governments in charge and doesn't question them. And they help their partners to stay in charge. This includes their contribution in the background to surveillance in the cyberspace, something they are really, really good in. Huawei is the leading company creating Africa's IT structure, and this is certainly a major advantage for any kind of electronic surveillance.
That was Wolfgang Poschtei, senior advisor at the Austrian Institute for Security, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shinawi. U.S. President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump traded barbs online yesterday while agreeing to debate each other in person at least twice prior to November's general election rematch. We have details from VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman in Washington.
CNN reports the Democratic Party incumbent and the Republican challenger are scheduled to debate on June 27th, while ABC says a second Trump-Biden debate will be held on September 10th. The announcements came within hours of the president and his predecessor taunting each other about debates. Biden, in a video posted to social media platforms, said Trump lost two debates to him in 2020 and is now acting like he wants to meet again.
Well, make my day, pal. I'll even do it twice. So let's pick the dates, Donald. I hear you're free on Wednesdays.
Trump currently does not have to be in court in New York City on Wednesdays during his criminal hush money trial. That trial is likely to conclude before next month's first scheduled debate. Trump on his Truth Social platform responded he's ready and willing to debate and wants more encounters than the June and September dates. Steve Herman, VOA News, Washington.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Ihiyes Wuhid in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.